Organizing the Unhoused, an Organizer's Manual, originally published at sabomedia.noblogs.org.
Once you have freedom from wage slavery, then join the grand industrial band. Once you from misery and hunger be free, come on to your share, lend a hand.
I wrote this booklet because I find it difficult to sleep in my nice warm bed, in my nice warm house, when there are so many people around me sleeping rough in winter conditions. Forcing people to sleep outside is an intolerable crime that would be considered unacceptable for prisoners of war. People who are forced to sleep outside are being treated by the government worse than enemy combatants. People who live in houses and do nothing but watch this situation unfold should be deeply ashamed of themselves. I want to give you and the people around you tools to start a radical union of unhoused people and get more dignity, safety, and respect as soon as possible. This booklet is short and to the point because people don't have extra time. I'm sorry it's not shorter, but I felt everything that I included was very important. I apologize if anything is unclear. Please give any feedback you have to the person who gave you this zine or send it to aberdeeniww@riseup.net. And it will be incorporated into the next edition. A word on words. Some people prefer the term houseless, some people prefer the term homeless, some people prefer the term unhoused people. I mostly default to houseless, but maybe you don't like this term very much. That's okay, I'm just some guy, don't put too much stock into what I say.
There is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand.
Part 0. Build trust, fight bigotry. The most important part of organizing a community union is to build friendly, trusting relationships. Today, we live in a society based on patronage. Patronage teaches me that I should only do things for other people if there's something in it for me. It also teaches me that we don't have anything in common. We're all merely individuals in competition with each other. But in reality, we're all in this together, and we have a lot more to gain by cooperating with each other instead of competing. Our goal is to live in a society based on solidarity. Solidarity is not an abstract political idea or an ideological tool. Solidarity is helping people to get to their doctor's appointments. It's getting to know people. Hanging out, whether in groups or even just one-on-one, for a few minutes while waiting at the bus stop. Asking people how they're doing, listening to them vent, or buying them a cup of coffee. Solidarity is a man calling out other men for saying something misogynist when there are no women around. Solidarity means having someone's back without expecting anything in return. Sometimes it even means having someone's back when we stand to lose something. It means looking for the best in people and showing them that you see it in a way that makes them want to fight boldly towards their own liberation. It's also the recognition that all of our destinies are tied together. A victory for one is a victory for all. Solidarity is the practice of focusing on people's needs before assigning them duties. Hand in hand with this is the necessity of fighting against bigotry and the curiarchy. The curiarchy is a catch-all term for the different spokes which make up the intersectional wheel of racism, misogyny, homophobia, ableism, ageism, transphobia, classism, colonialism, and the many other fucked up things which crush us on a daily basis. These privileges and marginalizations assigned to various people serve a practical purpose within capitalism, to keep the people divided. Ending oppression is at the core of what we are doing here. To dismiss combating bigotry and curiarchy as unimportant or of secondary importance would be a massive mistake and has been the primary failure of the left so far. When we focus on friendliness and mutual respect, along with transparent, honest communication and fighting bigotry, mutual trust will naturally follow. To build a union, you and your fellow community members don't all have to like each other, but you do all have to trust each other. None of the information in this booklet will be useful to you if you cannot build a group of people who trust each other. But with trust in each other and a plan of action, nothing can stop you. Part 1. Start asking questions. Why start a community union? Organizing together is the most effective way to turn the balance of power in the community towards the people. If you want more control over your daily life, cooperating with the people around you is the fastest way to get there. What is a union? A union is two or more people working together to change their community. A union doesn't need recognition from the government, nonprofits, or other unions. Although these things can be good long-term goals, the very first unions obviously didn't have them. Early unions started from small groups of people, deciding they had had enough, that something had to be done, and that they were the only ones who were going to do it. No one told them to do it. In fact, a lot of people told them it couldn't be done. They did it anyway. Unions began in the middle of the 19th century as secret organizations of workers uniting against workplace abuse, lousy pay, dangerous conditions, long hours, workplace harassment and bigotry, and many other problems. It took many years of unionists facing violence, imprisonment, financial hardship, and death, but ultimately their struggles and sacrifices brought us many things which we now take for granted. They fought first for the 12, then the 8-hour workday, and when they won that, they kept fighting for the 4-hour workday, which we'll accomplish soon. From the creation of workplace safety standards and retirement plans to the end of child labor and legal racial gender discrimination in the workplace, the historic labor movement achieved massive advances for working people, some of which still benefit us today. In the early 1920s and 30s, a union called the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, organized houseless and unemployed folks under the principle of organizing workers, not jobs. Strong unions controlled hiring and firing across their whole industries, started direct aid programs for community members, advocated local federal governance, and built apartment buildings for their union members to live in. This was cut back by the ruling class with the Red Scare in the 1950s, and then the Reagan-era attacks on labor in the 1980s. But we can have all of this again when we build a new, stronger, resurgent union movement. All it takes is a few secret organizations taking a stand against capitalism. Solidarity unionism is the practice of building democratic unions from the bottom up. Those of us practicing solidarity unions don't focus solely on the workplace like more traditional trade unionism. We don't have expensive union dues or a ton of bureaucrats. We don't even need to organize with anyone beyond our own community if we don't want to. We're just ordinary working people struggling so that we can all have better lives. We believe that regular people know how to run their lives better than the government or landlords or anyone else. As a result, we should be collectively making the decisions around our communities. As community organizers, our most effective tool is asking people questions. Here are the most important. What would you change if you were in charge? Who benefits from that? Do you think that's right? How are we going to change it? Part 2. Record everything. Get a notebook and start recording information about the community. Keep a diary or log. Record what happens, even if it seems relatively meaningless. Recording things may be boring, but this is how we detect useful patterns. This also lets us look back on a timeline of our community organizing campaign. We can use this to see what is working and what doesn't work, and give us ideas about where to go in the future. To change the community, first we have to understand the community. We understand the community by recording information about it, analyzing that information, and then coming up with new plans and ideas. The strength of a decentralized community union is in turning all of its members into member organizers. What do organizers do? We read, write, think, and talk. We learn about the community so that we can act strategically to help the community in the biggest ways. It would be cool if there were plucky reporters going around gathering info for truth-telling local newspapers. Unfortunately, we don't live in that world, so we have to do these things ourselves. A lot of the oppression that occurs under capitalism is only tolerated because people simply don't know about it. Many housed people don't understand how desperate things are for the unhoused. We should collect these stories and specific info about these people so that we can organize housed and unhoused people together and really begin to change things for the better around here.
Cloakers, pay attention to what I'm gonna mention. What is the fixed intention of the workers of the world? That we should all be ready, true-hearted, brave, and steady, to gather round our standard where the flag is unfurled. Where the phrase of the river flows, each fellow worker knows they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, folks, shorter hours and higher pay, folks, and we're gonna win the day, folks, where the phrase of the river flows.
Part 3. One-on-ones and meetings. A one-on-one is just a conversation between you and a community member. This is one of the main ways we build the union, especially early on. In a one-on-one, you should ideally be talking 20% of the time and listening 80% of the time. Also, it shouldn't last for more than about an hour. In general, 2 hours should be a hard limit for any union meeting. Using time wisely is extremely important. We're all already tired. We should be humbly and respectfully grateful for this time and respect our community members' strength for taking time out of their day to show up and make the world a better place. Don't drink a bunch or smoke hella weed or anything silly like that. We don't want anyone to get overly bold or agree to something while they're drunk and then feel manipulated later. We're not hanging out either. We can hang out immediately afterwards, but make a clear space for an organized conversation about the community. Coffee or tea and snacks are great if you can manage them. Sharing food and music builds trust between people. You should take notes at a meeting. A meeting is different from an informal conversation because a meeting has an agenda beforehand and notes taken and distributed afterwards. These are both important as they allow people who may not be present at the meeting to participate by reviewing the notes later and submitting items to the next agenda, and also just to form an important record of what decisions have been made. Larger meetings. Ultimately, the point of having one-on-ones with community members is to start having large community union meetings. Union meetings should be somewhat formal and have an appointed facilitator and separate note taker. The facilitator is not in charge, presenting information or telling anyone what to do. Rather, the facilitator is there to do things like taking stack, supporting the group in staying on topic, using time wisely, and addressing the role of privilege dynamics in the group. The note taker is there to record how people voted and write clear notes to communicate relevant information, what happened at the meeting, to people who aren't able to make it. These tasks are crucially important to building unions and ending oppression and should be undertaken by fair, emotionally aware people. But to avoid the development of harmful power dynamics, these positions should also be regularly rotated. Ideally, everyone in the union should learn all of the skills involved in running the union for redundancy and transparency. Quick note about taking stack. Taking stack is a tool of democratic decision making which we typically aren't taught in this oppressive society. Here it is in a nutshell. If someone decides they have something to say during a meeting while someone else is talking, they raise their hand. The person who is taking stack then writes down their name. When the person who is currently speaking is done, the stack taker calls on the next person on the stack to speak. A so-called progressive stack involves pushing people with traditionally marginalized identities and perspectives to the top of the stack, above those whose perspectives are more dominant in our culture. This can be a great way to make arrogant white dudes less likely to derail shit, while encouraging those who are wary of speaking up due to the constant bigotry in our society. However, a progressive stack must also be approached with care, as it also involves necessitating that people out themselves as queer, trans, disabled, an immigrant, or marginalized in some other invisible way that they don't wish to be public about. Progressive stacks can be contentious and/or alienating to some people, but enacting their spirit, if not their letter, is ultimately crucially important to building a culture of liberation. A lot of how you proceed here depends on the character of your specific community. As you can see, this is why choosing a good facilitator to take stack is important. You need to find someone who is aware of both privilege dynamics and people's emotions. An in-depth analysis of these methods is beyond the scope of this booklet, but it's worth reading about. It's also important to, if you can, offer childcare so parents can participate in the meetings. If you can afford these things, having food and coffee or tea at your meetings is extremely cool and will make your campaign stronger. Getting to the point where you can afford these things from regular donations and/or union dues could be a good first goal. Looping in with food and drinks, a larger meeting should start and end with some kind of group-centering exercise that contributes to a sense of community and welfare between the people present. This will look like very different things in different workplaces and communities, but it's really important to build trust and unity in the group. Union meetings are as much about building emotional connections as practical concerns. A meeting needs an agenda. It's good to set up the agenda in some kind of Google Doc or something so people can contribute to it in the lead up to the meeting. An agenda means discussing and determining concrete goals and outcomes of previous actions. Start and end on time. Informal talking is okay afterwards, but don't make hard decisions. A meeting is not a conversation because a meeting has notes on a facilitator. A conversation is not a meeting because it is not transparently accessible to union members not present, and it is thus not a space for formal democratic decision making. When you begin discussing an agenda item, decide how long you will talk about it. I recommend actually sticking to it by using a timer. It's rare that agenda items truly need more than 10 minutes of discussion. Use meeting time wisely. It is possibly the most valuable resource we have. Encourage people who are generally long-winded to keep it short, and support people who are usually staying quiet to speak up. Build a culture that supports progressive attitudes towards questioning narratives, uplifting traditionally silenced perspectives, unorthodox thinking, and liberated, nonviolent communication. Face conflict with serenity and trust. If your meetings are regularly going beyond 2 hours, they need better facilitation. You're not going to accomplish much with poor facilitation, no matter how much time you spend in meetings. Meetings going on for too long will sap energy from your campaign. Avoid long meetings at all costs. Prioritize agenda items so you can talk about anything time-sensitive first. Be honest with yourselves. Most things can wait until the next meeting. Treating everything as a crisis is a form of toxic urgency. It's almost always better to deal with something next week than it is to make everyone stay later than planned at a meeting. By the same token, make sure your meetings start on time. Activist meetings starting late is a bad, boring stereotype. It's fine if individuals show up late, but formal meetings with facilitators should start sharply at their posted time. If your meetings are regularly starting late, address the problem. Don't accept it. People have other appointments, they have to make their shifts, or go to sleep, or pick up relatives, or take medications. The entire point of what we're doing here is getting more free time for working people. Do not waste people's time.
They go wild, simply wild over me. Though I've never done the long that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me. And he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me. And I plainly saw we never could agree. So I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me.
Part 4. AEIOU. This is a way to remember a good general flow that a one-on-one conversation could follow. AEIOU. Agitate, educate, inoculate, organize, understand. Agitate. The idea is to get fired up with a community member about a situation that's currently fucking up our lives. Sometimes you might have to ask a couple questions to figure out exactly the best issue to push someone on. It might not be the most obvious thing. What we want to do is find out how this community member is emotionally impacted by specific problems. When organizing with houseless people, this step is usually not very difficult. Educate. Suggest a solution to the problem that all of us community members could accomplish together. See Part 7, Tactics. Or tell a story about a successful campaign of houseless people elsewhere. Agitation poses a problem, and education demonstrates how we think solidarity unionism can solve that problem. Ask people to imagine how their community could be different. Who has the power to resolve these issues? Why aren't they? How can we take the power to resolve these issues ourselves? Inoculate. We don't want people to get so riled up that they do anything hasty. So, we inoculate by discussing the bad things that could happen as a result of organizing. But we also discuss plans we have for dealing with those setbacks. This serves two purposes. One, we give people realistic expectations and don't set their hopes up too high. Two, we also show that we have seriously thought these things through and have not just a plan, but we've considered how that plan might go wrong and already made backup plans. Don't act as though what we're asking people to do is totally without risks. But there are already many risks from remaining in this current situation as well. Organizing together has the potential to help us all out in unexpected ways. Organize. Ask our community member to take on a concrete task related to organizing the community, such as having a one-on-one with a community member they get along with but you don't know very well, or developing a social chart or map of their section of the community, or it can even be as simple as meeting up and having another one-on-one with you in 2 weeks. Giving people tasks is crucial, not only because it makes them feel wanted and included, but also because sometimes they actually do them. It's extremely important to check in with people like a week or two later and see if they did the task. Approach it casually and non-judgmentally, because we're all busy and they probably didn't do it. If they did, that's awesome. If they didn't, they might just need some support or maybe a different task. There's nothing wrong with that. Understand. Here we pause and take stock of the situation and what we've learned. We think about whether it's time to escalate the situation or if this community member isn't fired up enough yet. Escalation could mean something like asking this person to take out a union card and or commit to taking part in a protest action. But if they don't seem interested, then you can circle back to agitation and repeat the whole process as necessary, possibly in a future one-on-one. Escalating things is important, however, because if you don't, you're not organizing. If your community sees you just forming committees and having endless meetings, but not actually accomplishing things, not actually solving problems for the community, they'll start to lose confidence in the union campaign. After you have a one-on-one, take notes on what you talked about as soon as possible afterwards, what the person seemed to feel, what was discussed, how they reacted, if they agreed to do anything. Part 5. Community mapping and social charting. Draw a map of the place where you live. Mark things like where the police stations are, where the security cameras are, where there are community resources such as shelters, libraries, clinics, etc. Where there are encampments. Where could we have a secret conversation without being seen together on a camera? In the event of a protest, what could we block with a picket line? Or where else would be a highly visible place? Are there areas where the city says people should camp? Do people actually camp there? Why or why not? How is the physical layout of the community used against us? How can we use the physical layout of the community against the ruling class? Next, we're going to draw a map of the relationships between people in the community. Social charting has several purposes. Primarily, it tracks how information flows around the community. It allows us to see both formal and informal lines of communication. An example of formal communication could be the city government sending memos to nonprofit shelters, and informal communications would be social conversations and/or gossip. Social charting answers questions like, who hangs out together? Who trusts each other? Who is political? Who is dating or married? Who shares religious community? Who goes to whom for help when shit goes down? Social charting allows us to see how the identity of individual community members intersects with the community, and critically examine the ways our community members are variously privileged and marginalized. It is our most important duty to make sure that our organizing doesn't reproduce any oppressive behavior. We are here to liberate everyone, and that means starting by supporting the most oppressed. When the most oppressed people get what they want, we all get what we want. Social charting is also the foundation of relational security. By allowing us to visualize how information flows around the community, we can see who we should be organizing with first and who we should avoid. Most communities have some individuals who wield informal social power for various reasons. We need to be aware of these people and the influence they can have positively and/or negatively on a unionization campaign. Anecdotally, I think in a given situation, roughly 15% of the people will do something positive, 15% of the people will do something negative, and everyone else just does whatever the person next to them does. These aren't meant to be exact numbers, just something to think about. We need to be very aware of people's tendency to go along with the majority group dynamics and take advantage of it rather than let it be used against us. Basically, I'm not saying organize with the popular people first, but like, do think about how popular people will react if they're not included. Finally, social charting allows us to assemble contact information for our community members. Some folks are not going to have regular access to phones and computers, and in-person connections will always be preferable. A good social chart includes some kind of contact list, even if it's just something like an intersection where a person can often be found.
In the gloom of mighty cities, midst the roar of whirling wheels, we are sailing on like feudal serfs of old. And our masters hope to keep us ever thus beneath their heels, and to coin our very lifeblood in gold. But we have a glowing dream of a fair world we'll see, when each one can live their life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor, and there's joy,
Part 6, Escalation Strategy. When planning, performing, and analyzing an action, consider the following. Issue, what is the specific immediate problem? Demand, what could be done to fix the situation? Who has this power? Why is it not already being fixed? Goal, what is the desired outcome? Is it growing the campaign by showing strength? Is it setting up the local government to deny reasonable requests so they look like assholes? Target. How are you going to make the target do what you want? What is the most effective path to that goal for the least energy and resources? Participants. Organized community members who are actively taking part in the action. Witnesses. Other community members who aren't in the union campaign, including bystanders. Anyone who may be present but isn't directly involved. Results. What happened? Did you win or receive an acceptable good faith counteroffer? Follow-up. After the action has taken place, follow up with the participants and witnesses and see how the action impacted them. Also, follow up with the target to ensure that they keep any promises they may have made. Also, think about what you would do better next time. Escalation. If the demand is not met, what steps will you take to increase pressure on the target? Different tactic? Same tactic, but with more participants? Same tactic, but with a different target? Etc. Part 7. Tactics. These are arranged roughly from lower intensity to higher intensity. Think about things like this. Would the target be more upset by a procedural legal challenge or by being publicly embarrassed? Would talking shit on the internet help or just annoy them? Would they be more uncomfortable with people flyering outside of their workplace or outside of their home? Would it be better to file some kind of appeal to a higher government authority or to occupy a local government building? Be cautious. Be smart. Don't get caught. Public shaming. Leave shitty reviews all over the internet, social media, etc. Reach out to local businesses and community orgs, flyer, post signs, attend city council meetings, protest outside the mayor's house, anything you can think of. Make sure your messaging is clear. Phone zap. Organize as many community members as possible to call into your target at the same time and complain about the same issue. Could also be an email zap, text zap, social media zap, etc. Information acquisition. Pretend to be someone you're not, on the internet or on the phone, and people might give you very different information than if you approach them genuinely. As just one example to get you thinking, a boss might say all kinds of interesting shit to someone they think is a sympathetic journalist that they would never say to their own employees. Think laterally. Someone I know outed an infiltrator by calling the guy's parents and pretending to be an insurance salesman. They were thrilled to brag about their son, the FBI agent. March on the boss. Get a large group of people together and interrupt whatever your target is doing, ideally in a highly public and embarrassing fashion. Present them with a list of demands signed by as many community members as you can get. Be dramatic. Boycott. Call for community members to stop supporting a business or businesses until your demands are met. Picket line. This involves you and your community members forming a line outside of the target's workplace, including protest banners, flags, songs, chants, and pamphlets about what you're doing to hand out to people. Getting people trained on marshaling a protest, keeping an eye out for nonsense, and being ready to talk down pigs and hired goons is very important, but beyond the scope of this booklet. Squatting, occupying buildings against the wishes of their owners and the cops. Ultimately, as believers in solidarity, our final goal is to strike, occupy, and take over. The community already belongs to the people. Let's take it back. Do whatever you and your community members think is necessary to achieve your union's demands. Make up new tactics, outsmart your targets, and inspire the rest of us. Part 8. Stories. Besides asking questions, the next most important tool we have is telling stories. Stories are how we connect what's happening in our lives to the larger struggle, and how we learn about what others have achieved. Stories are much, much more important than economic or political theories because they're grounded in real life. Here's a story. During the Great Depression, people set up mutual aid networks all over and organized communities to prevent evictions and foreclosures. These piecemeal efforts were formalized by the Roosevelt administration after the fact into many of the banking regulations which ended the Depression. Those regulations were removed in the 80s and led to the 2008 recession. The mutual aid networks were formalized into Social Security and other welfare programs which have been chiseled away ever since. The government didn't give us these things initially, and it doesn't have the right to take them away. Here's a story. Back in the 20s and 30s, unions built huge apartment buildings for their members to live in for free. Unions ran entire mill towns as collective enterprises. Everyone hired in particular industries had to be hired through specific union halls. Many workers today don't appreciate how much we've lost, even simple pleasures like the ability to talk shit about the companies we work for without worrying about getting fired. Here's a story. During the Spanish Civil War, the Transit Workers Union assumed direct control of all the streetcars and buses in the city. They improved pay, instituted democratic worker control of the shops and stations, and significantly expanded service, even in the context of wartime shortages of tools and materials. There are relatively few stories of successful organizing amongst houseless people. We need your help to make more. If we organize community members to the point where they are organizers themselves, and they can go on to start campaigns of their own, possibly in new communities. We are a light, fast, hard-hitting resistance to the ruling class's slow-moving authoritarian bureaucracy. We are black cats who thrive on fucking shit up from the shadows. Every day there are more of us, and we're winning. Part 9. Marxist Economics for People Without Jobs. Back in the day, a guy named Karl Marx wrote a lot of interesting shit. Later, a guy named Big Bill Haywood shortened it to, "If one person has a dollar they didn't work for, someone else worked for a dollar they didn't get." That's most of what most people need to know about Marxist theory. We don't need jargon to know that bosses and landlords are assholes. We don't need theory to know that our families deserve to live better. And we know how to run our communities better than theorists who have never even been here. The problem is already that we're being told what to do, and our society develops fucked up situations because the people who are telling us what to do don't understand us. I have no time for a new system which keeps telling people what to do. I'm not against theory, but most people on the left massively overemphasize it. Putting things into practice is much more important. Oppose book worship. If you must study theory, you should at least study it in groups. We need more strong social groups capable of autonomous group self-education, and we need fewer highly educated individuals accomplishing nothing alone. If you don't own some company or a bunch of houses, and you're not a cop or a corrections officer, you're in the working class. We, the working class, built all of this shit. All of the houses, apartments, schools, roads, factories, cafes, and shops. Without us living in the community would not exist. But almost all of us have people barking useless orders over us, with no recourse for true justice. I think we can take control of our lives and make everything better. We built all of this shit, but we didn't build it to be broke next to billionaires. We didn't build all of this shit to live in vans and tents. We didn't build all this shit so the military could blow up kids in Southwest Asia with flying robots. And we definitely didn't build all this shit to die in a climate change-induced superstorm on our way to some fucked up warehouse job that we had to pee in a jar to get in the first place. Instead of a world of free housing, landlords take a high portion of our money simply because they are owners and already had enough money to buy a home. This is a backwards situation wherein people who don't work steal money they don't need from people who do all the work. Capitalism is essentially the belief that since it could be difficult to address this kind of theft, we should just give up and let bribery rule our entire society, and the least corrupt people will somehow rise to the top through some method which is never fully explained. I think that's bullshit. I think all of our lives would be better if we didn't live in a system that glorified greed. I think all of us in our hearts know that we not only deserve better, but we can do better. What do we have to show for all these years that we've struggled? How long is this going to go on? Was it right that your ancestors struggled hard all their lives just to die broke? Do you want to struggle like this for the rest of your life, just to be broke? Do you want the next generation to struggle like this for all of their lives, just to still be fucking broke?
The union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Before sun or
fish, capitalism tries to make us feel foolish and small.
But the union makes us strong.
For not having a better attitude. For being houseless, for not being a self-starter, for not going to college, or if we did, for not studying the right degree. In short, for not working harder to build up other people's shit instead of our own. And that as a result, we deserve the treatment we get. But no one deserves to be treated like this. No one deserves to be poor. No one deserves to live without access to basic necessities. No one deserves to face bigotry. No one deserves to be arbitrarily ordered around and humiliated. No one deserves to be exposed to disease, or unsafe temperatures, or toxic chemicals, or predatory businesses, or uncompassionate shelters. No one deserves to live in this fucked up society, so we have to change it. We aren't weak people being held down by the strong. We are strong people being held back by the weak. Part 10. What next? Our ultimate goal is total liberation and social revolution through economic democracy. Mass worker control of all workplaces, tenant control of housing, in short, community control over communities. We look forward to building a democratic and participatory planned economy capable of meaningfully responding to climate change by decolonizing so-called North America. This means workers firing all of the bosses and managers and pigs and landlords, closing the banks and stock markets, disallowing people to price gouge food, water, clothing, and housing. If the community controls the way these things are produced, then we can end the market-enforced scarcity, which keeps 1 in 5 children in the U.S. going to bed without enough food on the table, and where at this very moment, over 1.5 or 2 million children are houseless. We can and must leave this world of precarity behind. We want to see workers directly voting to determine their workplace's budget, operations, salaries, schedules, policies, hiring, firing, and discipline. We want to see no people without houses, and no houses without people. In short, we want, for the first time ever, to give everyone the right to control their own destiny. There is no reason to let these assholes control our lives. We have the power. All we have to do is love and respect ourselves enough to take back what already belongs to us. I came to organizing because I spent my whole life bailing on things and running away when they didn't suit me. Jobs, relationships, scenes, cities. Embarrassingly late, I realized I could never run far enough. If I wanted to live to see the stronger, kinder world, which stands tall in my dreams, then I had to turn around and fight. Beyond the information in this booklet, I don't know what needs to happen next. And that's partially for you, the person reading this right now, to figure out. I don't know your life, your community, and there are many things about both which are totally unique. I don't know exactly what you need to get free, but I have absolutely no doubt that we will get free together. I promise you that in our lifetimes, we are going to build a world without fear. The fastest way to get to that world is by doing things which have never been done before. Please fight the system. There are other rebels out there.